The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello! Hi, everybody, and welcome! Welcome to the Lunarverse. I'm Dr. Charles Liu, your host, but please, call me Chuck. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you our co-host, as always, Alan Liu. Hey, Alan, how's it going?
Hi, it's going pretty well.
Oh, really glad to see you. And our special guest for today, whom we will talk about at great length about all kinds of geeky fun, computer scientist Meister, weather Meister, entrepreneur Meister, Andy Green. Hey, Andy, how's it going?
Hey, Chuck, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, really glad to have you. And we can't wait to get into all that stuff about you, what you do, especially when it comes to weather and atmospheric science and just computer geeking out. But first, we will go to today's joyfully cosmic cool thing. And it has to do with weather on a different planet. In fact, on Jupiter. The James Webb Space Telescope in the summer of 2022 released an amazing space-based image in the infrared of Jupiter and its ring system and a couple of moons hiding out and the amazing atmospheric conditions on the surface. We have haze, we have bright white great red spot. It's white because it's reflecting the light coming from the sun in toward us. And you have clouds and features like you would never see on Earth because of the incredible cosmic size and energy that's welling up from Jupiter, and auroras that are shining in the north and the southern pole area, larger than planet Earth itself. It's a really incredibly cool picture. Check it out. But maybe the coolest thing about this image is that it was processed and shared with us all by a citizen scientist, not someone who does this for a living, but someone who does it just because they loved it. Indeed, the person's name is Judy Schmidt. She lives in California, and she's been processing images from space telescopes for 10 years, just as a hobby, just for fun. It's just really amazing how you can produce something so amazing, something so professional, something so transformational, just because you like to do it, not because it's some obligation or some career track that you're doing. Andy, I know that this is something that really can resonate with you because you have done basically that in your life, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, honestly, I remember seeing the first pictures of Jupiter way back when Carl Sagan's Cosmos was on the air back in the 70s. And I remember what the images look like now. And boy, I mean, seeing what we can get out of James Webb is just absolutely kind of inspiring. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why it makes you kind of happy and excited to be in the space business.
Completely. And you, too, have built a career, an amazing life, business, work out of what is essentially a hobby, not necessarily what you trained for academically, right?
Yeah, that's true. I got into computers when I was young, around 9 years old, and I've just kind of stuck with it ever since. It's definitely been a life's passion to kind of play around with these toys, for sure.
Super cool. Okay, so tell us a little bit about My Radar and that amazing atmospheric science that you're doing for us on a day-to-day basis for all of us who are users or those of us who are just interested in that kind of scientific application. And then we'll get to a question.
Yeah. So My Radar is a mobile app that's basically really good at showing you the weather, as well as a few other things, earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, that sort of thing. But we've kind of focused on being an app, a mobile app that shows the weather over the last several years, but we kind of started trying to tackle some of the science challenges behind providing that weather information. And so we kind of started branching out into the satellite business, and I guess we can kind of get into some of that here in a little bit.
Fantastic. Yes, we absolutely will. Okay, first, Alan, do we have a question for Andy?
Yeah, so the first question that we are asking, we got a couple questions today. This one comes from Anthony, who's asking, how much impact and change do you actually see from global warming in the near future?
Ooh, a weather guy. Asking a weather person about global warming. Can't imagine a better person to answer that question, Andy.
Yeah, Anthony, that's actually a very good question. And unfortunately, I think we're likely to see quite a bit of impact from it. We're already kind of seeing that today in the wildfires that have popped up out in the Midwest and the Western states, even around the rest of the world, flooding in India and in Germany and Europe from last year. We're still in a bit of a bind, and we're definitely behind in trying to tackle some of the problems that are causing climate change. So that's one of our missions, to try to help, you know, kind of educate the public and make sure that people are aware of some of the things and the steps that we can take to help mitigate the effects. But we're unfortunately in for a bit of a bumpy ride.
And this is not from like news reports. You are the data. I mean, you have actually watched this happen for real, not with any kind of filters, not with anybody telling you what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. While weather alone is not necessarily an immediate indicator of climate change, I can say that, you know, part of my job is to sit there and stare at weather screens all day long. And I've been sort of doing that for the last 10 years. And it's, you know, it's hard to escape the reality that storms have been becoming more and more severe. And the impacts from the storms have been more devastating to people. So, I mean, I've seen it playing out in the last several years. And it looks like we're going to continue that trend unless we can make some really big changes.
Wow. Okay. Well, thanks, Anthony, for that question. We have another student question coming up later, I think. But right now, let's dive right into that technology, the space stuff that you're referring to. How many users does MyRadar have?
So MyRadar's got about 13 million active monthly users.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. Pretty good. This is all off your phone, right? I mean, you don't have to get a computer or anything like that. You can just do that.
That's correct. We do have an app that runs on Windows, but it's mostly on your mobile device. That's where we're most useful when you want to check weather on the go, that sort of thing.
Okay. And are you a specialist in severe weather or like ordinary weather, just like whether it's going to get wet or not, or like where it's actually a tornado coming, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So, well, me personally, I'm more of a computer nerd and not so much the weather expert, but the app itself is very good at keeping people apprised of current weather conditions, but also emerging weather events and severity. So we put a lot of good artificial intelligence to use to kind of analyze the weather and do the proactive work to notify you ahead of time of what's coming. So we're really good at telling you when the rain is going to start. That's one of our best features, I think. But I think also just from a standpoint of situational awareness, we're really good at being able to show where severe weather might be popping up, what kind of weather warnings are going to be issued, hurricane tracking, that sort of thing.
Wow.
Very handy if you're out on the go.
Yeah, no kidding. I had heard that I've known about Tornado Alley in the United States for quite some time now, but have I heard correctly there's now a second Tornado Alley?
Yeah, it seems to be shifting a little bit. So just in general, Tornado Alley is this region in the Midwest of the United States. We're actually a little bit unique here in this country in the way our geography is set up. Mm. We can kind of experience weather events that are not necessarily that common in other parts of the world. Mm. We definitely see the most tornadoes in the world. And it's really, like I said, a result of the geography here. We have the mountains in the middle western state part of the states that kind of separates the warm, moist air that comes in from the Gulf and the cold air that comes in from the West. And what happens is when that air during the right time of the year, when it comes over those mountains and the cold air meets up with the warm air that comes up from the Gulf, it's basically just tornado food. It's fuel for tornadoes. And so there's this region of the Midwest out there that's basically really prone to tornadoes, especially around springtime. There's some evidence that the region is kind of shifting to the southeast a little bit. Isn't really any confirmed links just yet that it's related to climate change. But as the climate continues to evolve, we will be surprised by these changes in the events and how the system, the global weather system, plays out.
Wow. Tell us about the science, the technology, I guess you should say. Tell us about the technology surrounding the satellite work that you're doing, the ways that you're going to try to make weather prediction or weather sensing more fancy than we have now, more stronger than we have now, better than we have
now.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, I think I mentioned this earlier, but we started as just a regular app, you know, a software company that made an app that was kind of useful to people. But we realized that we could kind of put our heads together and employ some smarts and start tackling some of the science challenges behind gathering weather information and then assembling it and putting it to useful visualizations for users. We started doing that several years ago, and that's kind of how we've grown out the functionality of our app and what we can do with it. But what was really a big eye-opener for us was a couple years back, we realized that if we had put our own sensors into space, we could gather additional information that would help us to improve forecasts and weather predictions even more. And so we've started on that journey, and we've actually had a lot of fun with it.
So your phone weather app has its own satellite technology backing it right now.
Not yet. It will. So, we did launch, three prototype engineering satellites, earlier in the year on a Rocket Lab launch out of New Zealand.
Oh,
that was a lot
of
fun.
Awesome.
So right now we actually have three satellites orbiting the Earth, taking images and sending back some, early, hardware validation tests, things like that.
Okay.
But you can actually load up the app and, track the objects in orbit above you. There's a little layer you can turn on where you can see the satellites above your head and you can kind of follow them and watch when they're overhead.
That's really cool.
That's amazing. Did you like borrow NASA's facilities or you know, European Space Agency down in Guyana? I mean, how did you do this?
No, so it's actually the industry is actually opening up. I mean, obviously in the early years it was a very small club to be able to afford and have the science and the capability to put something into orbit.
Yeah.
But technology, thanks to innovators like Rocket Lab and SpaceX, it's a little bit easier to put things into orbit so that companies like ours can kind of innovate and play around and do crazy stuff and send things into orbit. So we built these engineering prototypes last year. There's definitely still a bit of regulatory.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Challenges that you have to go through, and we want to make sure that we're not going to drop satellites on somebody's house.
Yeah,
important.
But once you go through that work, you basically put those satellites onto a rocket. So we used Rocket Lab earlier in the year, and put them into orbit, and you get to watch them go, and it was pretty amazing.
That's great,
Alan. I think you've told me about Rocket Lab in the past. Is that right?
Yeah. So I know, presumably Andy knows a bunch of this too, given that he's worked with them. But yeah, they work. There is sort of U.S. New Zealand combined thing going on because of
New Zealand. Oh, so they launched from the Pacific.
Yeah. So they launched some rockets down there from I think Wahia Peninsula, something like that. And they're launching some in out of Wallops Island in Virginia sometime soon also. And they've like been a good player in that. They've been trying to catch their rockets with helicopters as they fall back to Earth. They haven't got one yet as of this recording, but hopefully they get one soon. And I think that's they're sending a mission to Venus sometime next year too. They've got some cool stuff going on.
Hooray for all these different rocket companies. I think that's terrific. And
there's a bunch of new rocket companies.
Yeah.
And it must feel really cool, Andy, to have like your own satellites up in space. I mean, that's
absolutely
cool.
It definitely allowed me to punch a notch on my nerd card for sure.
Definitely, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. It's very cool.
Wow. Now, tell us about that nerd card. I've been holding off, but you are a legend when it comes to old style, old school, best in breed, olden days type technology. And you, you weren't just playing around like I was. I was happy if I could write one line of code that would actually properly interpret without an error. You were doing real usage out of these computers that today we barely remember from the ancient history. I'm so impressed. You got to tell us about it. Just tell us all about it.
Yeah. So honestly, it was a long time ago. I got into computers actually when I was 9, so it was probably the late 70s. I just had this weird fascination with pushing buttons. And so Radio Shack had come out with their first computer. It was called the TRS-80, and they used to display it in the window. And I tell you, I used to go to that store every day for like a year and just sit there and play on the computer.
They were very good.
They were very good about it. I'm sure I caused them quite a bit of annoyance after a while. But I mean, it was, they knew I was just a kid, and they really let me have fun with it. And I can't, if I ever... if I could ever find those people that worked at that store, I'd be very happy to thank them, because it gave me an opportunity to kind of play with this toy and learn it on my own. And that was the thing. It went from this fascination of pressing buttons to just learning how to code. Like, I was literally, like you said, punching in code from a book and watching it run. And that was the biggest rush as a kid at that age, to be able to create something on a computer, you know, typing in lines of instructions and having the computer do something that you told it to do. And that just set me on a course for, you know, where I'm at today. And it was just, I feel really lucky that I got a chance to play with that at such an early age and get connected with it so early.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. I don't imagine you like own one.
I do.
What?
Well,
you do?
I am very nostalgic, absolutely. And there are still quite a few of those computers. You can find them on eBay if you go shopping around for them.
Wow.
But I have here at the office, I don't know if you can see this or not. I don't know if you want me to turn the camera around. We could try that.
Go for it. Give it a try.
Let's see.
Oh, my gosh.
We're going to have to describe this. There.
Oh, yeah. There it is. Yeah, we're going to describe
the big CRT
this to the
monitor there. You got the keyboard. Yeah. To sort of
so that is
to
a
it.
TRS-80 Model 3. And
wow.
It's sitting on a vintage computer desk. So I figured antique computers and antique desks. Even
yeah.
on top of it is an old acoustic modem.
Whoa!
But that is one of the computers I used to work on as a kid.
That's amazing. So for those of you who are just listening to this podcast and not watching it, it basically looks like a big toaster oven with a keyboard stuck on it. It's amazing.
It's got a screen too, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on the right side, did I see a couple of floppy drives?
You did, absolutely. And what's scarier is that I was around when those became a big thing. You know, when I first started playing with computers, you had to put in a cassette tape. It was very slow and tedious and cumbersome.
Wow.
But I remember the first time computers had kind of gotten modernized and they had floppy drives in them. And I remember the first time putting a floppy disk into a computer and just feeling this rush, you know,
wow.
Like you're going to be doing this a lot more in your lifetime. And sure.
I mean, I barely remember floppy disks myself. So,
oh man,
I was a CD-ROM era there.
Yeah. Much better at that point, but even so, yeah, floppy's remarkable. And I got to tell you, if you think about old movies like, you know, Stanley Kubrick, 2001: A Space Odyssey, you know, that came out in the 60s and stuff. That's what computers looked like to them. And that's exactly the kind of terminal that you would expect. Oh, that's where you're going to type in you know, computer and things like that. And that's what HAL's input output screens look like. And then, you know, a decade or more later, that's exactly what happened. And today, what we visualize, what computers might look like today, maybe that's what they'll look like years from now. It's just a remarkable sort of progression of just creative geekdom.
Yeah. Ironically enough, they used one of those, a dressed up version of those, in Star Wars Andor.
Wow.
Yeah. There's one scene in like the first episode, I think, where you can see it and it's got some extra lights on it. But it's kind of funny because it's come full circle. Watching a movie about futuristic, you know, technology, and there they are using something from the 70s. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Kind of funny.
That is
wow.
Kind of
so
funny.
We have to give a moment of props for the TRS-80. May Radio Shack always rest in knowledge that they changed the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what do you think computers will look like years from now, Andy? I mean, you're the one who's putting onboard artificial intelligence onto your systems here.
Yeah,
what's going to be the future?
I'll be honest with you. It's going to be absolutely crazy, because if you look at just the last several years and how much things have changed, I mean, you know, they say that there's a big upset, a revolution in how people consume their media on a computer every 10 or 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. We've gone from big screens. Then we made this big jump to mobile phones where everybody's consuming their data now.
Yeah.
And I think the industry is kind of really believing that the next form of consumption would be augmented reality glasses. I know Apple's got an announcement coming up here pretty soon, but basically,
cool.
You know, you put them on and it augments reality. It takes, you're allowed to see, you know, what's outside the glasses, but it overlays some form of digital data on top of it. And there have been some companies that have tried it and failed, and I think maybe it was a little bit too ahead of its time, but I think that's probably going to be the next big thing, and it'll be interesting to see how well society deals with it, you know, having glasses on. It didn't go too well last time it happened, you know, I think people have gotten much more accustomed to the technology these days, so they're probably, I think it'll probably catch on, especially if, you know, somebody pulls it off and does it the right way.
Yeah, it's not going to be Google Glass all over again.
Oh, right. No. Bringing up bad memories. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
But that still means that, like, I, who ordinarily wear glasses, we hopefully can sort of add stuff to it so that anytime I go to a conference or something, I will never have to worry about forgetting the name of somebody.
Believe me, I am waiting for that invention because I need it really bad.
I mean, you can just use name tags, but they're boring.
Oh, yeah. No, name tags are great, but you know what? I don't know. I think science has yet to invent a name tag that won't flip over 180 degrees so you can't see the person's name. Instead, you see their drink tags.
I think it'd be much better for me to be able to pretend that I didn't forget somebody's name. So, Joe, right, got it, from last year, understood, right.
Awesome. All right, so do you think we'll be able to play games on those glassy computers?
Absolutely. We've already seen some examples of that. Pokemon Go was a really good example of something that kind of caught on virally. And that was, that was a little bit, that involved having a phone that you would hold up and take images of where you'd see virtual objects on it. So that's kind of was an early introduction to the concept, but absolutely, you'll be able to play games with it, with the glasses. And I think those are going to be some of the next up and coming applications that people are no doubt working on right now.
Yeah, I think 100%. That's great. Now, did you play games on the old TRS-80?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, that was, if anything, an indication of how good your imagination had to be. Because I used to love playing this game called Invasion Force. And, you know, being a Star Trek nerd kid, you know, watching Captain Kirk commanding the Enterprise, that was really cool. And I think every kid kind of daydreamed about that. And, you know, this game back then was all text-based. You know, you had, like, 40 characters wide screen, and it would draw like a bunch of pluses and symbols, and you could go around blowing up Klingon ships and navigating through space, and it was enough to really spur your imagination to kind of make you feel like you were in command of the Enterprise. So it was
very amazing. So the Klingon ships were plus signs.
Yes, they were like K's, I think, the letter K's. K.
Oh, okay. So the Enterprise would be like E.
I think so. I don't remember. It was amazing. That long ago, and my memory is not that great. But yeah, times have changed considerably. I mean, some of the games that I play now, it's sometimes kind of hard to distinguish it from reality. So
I'm
happy about that.
Like virtual reality games and stuff like that?
I did for the longest time, yeah. The one VR game that I played in particular was Elite Dangerous. And it was really cool because the object of that game is to fly a spaceship around, basically. You know, that's selling it short. But when you put those goggles on and you look around and you see the planets around you and you see the other ships flying by you, I have to admit, even in all of my years in playing in the computer industry, that was a huge monumental moment for me to experience that and see how different it was. It was kind of like an indication of how, you know, what's to come. Because even back then, you know, this was several years ago and the glasses weren't as good as they are now. And they're already getting, you know, leaps and bounds better, you know, in the next few versions of them. So, yeah, it's very neat when you get the right technology and it starts to break that barrier between reality and the game world.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I want to talk more about games, especially because Alan is a serious gamer and understands video games much better than I do, at least the modern versions. My version of video games is Space Invaders and Asteroids.
They're also good. Those are also good.
Yeah, they are. Okay,
they became popular for a reason.
That's true, they did. Last question. Talk us through how you got your satellites launched. What did that take? I think that's fantastic. If I had the wherewithal, I would launch my satellite in a heartbeat, right? Now, I know about CubeSats, which are, you're creating little payloads, and there are students all over the world that can make little tiny payloads. They all pile on to a single spacecraft, and they all get launched together. But you've done that next step. You have your own satellite. How did that happen? What did it take?
Well, I have to, you know, obviously confess here, it wasn't me alone. So there's about 40 people here at the company, but we have a really good team of really incredibly smart guys, smart engineers and talented people. And so it was really with their help that I was able to do it. I was kind of, you know, maybe the driving crazy force to say, let's give it a try. But these guys actually did all the work to make it happen. In fact, I've actually got one of the satellites here at some point. I can try to show you. I'll take
go
a quick
get it
look.
Now. Yeah,
and
yeah,
I'll
yeah.
try to.
See if you can
tell you
it.
A little bit of a story along the way. But the short version is we were talking earlier about some of these rocket companies and how there are a lot more of them coming on the market and bringing the prices down and allowing companies like ours to innovate. That's definitely made it easier. Really, anybody, you know, being able to put something into orbit used to take hundreds of millions of dollars, just several years ago. And now it can be brought down for under $100,000. You know, in some cases, you can build a satellite. There are people who have built satellites for under $1,000 and then launched them for $25,000. And, you know, that's just an idea. It's still, you know, it's not like you're going to shell it out your weekend cash fund for it. But it's still something it's that's like attainable if you can kind of gather your resources a little bit. Yeah. And that's going to open up the sluice for a lot of innovation in the future. People even smarter than, you know, the people that are working here are going to be able to put together some really cool technology and put it into orbit and do some amazing things with it.
Wow.
Let's see if I can show you. So
of you who are on the audio, Andy is just opening up a briefcase, something not much bigger than a bread box. And he's pulling out, there it is. He's pulled out a thing about the size of a Rubik's cube. But it's got a wire sticking out of it. Oh, two wires, obviously antennae of some kind. All right, tell us about this amazing thing.
So this is an engineering prototype. It's a copy of one of the ones that's in orbit. And this actual model may wind up going into orbit next year. It's very small. So this is what we call a pocket cube. Normally, CubeSats, they're in the form of a U, which is 10 centimeters squared. This one is 1/4 of the size. 1/8 of the size, sorry. And it's at 5 centimeters squared, cubed. And these little black things here are solar panels. And you were right, these are antenna. And so basically this device is, all this really is for us is just an engineering prototype. It's got some hardware on it that we'll put up into orbit and we'll just make sure that it works. Make sure that we don't have any problems with it, observe how it behaves, get some telemetry back from it. And then we'll use that data when we go to build our commercial satellites later on. So it is pretty neat, but the commercial satellites that we'll launch will be full 1U CubeSats.
Okay.
And they will have a suite of different sensors on them. There'll be a hyperspectral imager on it, a thermal imager, so you can look at temperature changes, and a visible camera on it.
Wow.
And it'll have some crazy artificial intelligence to kind of observe the planet and kind of keep a watchful eye on it 24/7 and then alert us when it sees something out of the ordinary, like wildfire hotspots. If there's if it flies over an area that's, you know, poorly vegetation that has poor moisture content, or just an area in general that's likely, you know, at a high risk of ignition during a wildfire, we can get an alert from that on the ground and then potentially notify authorities and fire management agencies to kind of go in there and proactively deal with the area and prevent it from becoming an issue later on. And that's one small part of it.
That's amazing. To think that something only a few inches on a side can do all of that. I mean, it's amazing. Are there thrusters? I mean, does it follow in orbit? How long will it stay in orbit?
So it'll stay in orbit for about 5 or 6 years. It's at an altitude of about 525,000 kilometers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have thrusters. But it does have some simple devices on it that help stabilize it. So there's something on it called a magnetorquer, which basically helps follow the Earth's magnetic field, and it uses that to stabilize it. So there's no air friction in orbit. Having just these magnets on board helps keep it pointed at the Earth and helps keep it stable. That was something I learned early on and realized, wow, that's pretty easy, pretty straightforward. We've also got some other things on there that help control the attitude and allow us to point it, but no thrusters on it.
So wait, do you mean 525,000 kilometers or 525,000 meters?
525 kilometers.
Okay, cool. It's more like the space station on the moon.
Yeah, no, my bad. I always get that messed up. It's actually a little bit lower than the space station, so.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. All right. So at that altitude, there's not much oxygen, so it'll probably be in orbit again for around 5 or 6 years or so, and then eventually its orbit will decay and it'll fall back to Earth.
All right. It'll burn up in the atmosphere, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. If it doesn't, I want it to land in my backyard. I want it. It's cute.
Aim it with the magnetorquer.
You might have to wait in line for that. You were asking about some of the things you have to do in order to launch, but that's one of the things you have to provide. We're getting much smarter about making sure that we take care of the orbit around the Earth and try to mitigate the effects of orbital debris. So whenever you launch a satellite, you have to provide a deorbit plan, which basically tells, you know, it spells out how long it's going to be in orbit and when it will break up. So that's kind of nice to know that we're at least paying attention to that.
That's terrific.
That's great.
And is one of the things that is required like a cute nickname? Because that is one actually photogenic little spacecraft. I mean, I would name it Magnetorker just because I think that's a great name, but you should come up with something cool.
So our commercial constellation is going to be called Horus. Horus with an I instead of U. And the idea is a little bit of Egyptian mythology there. Horus was able to kind of see the future. Right. The Horus satellite will actually be able to look at the Earth and kind of help us predict the future and kind of avoid wildfire outbreaks. Tropical cyclones will get a little bit better at being able to predict them and track them and a number of other things. So that's kind of what that. But what I can say, this one, the ones that are in orbit, our engineer calls them his babies. Every satellite, when it's in orbit, it sends out a beacon that's basically a brief little radio signal to tell you, hey, I'm here and alive. And the very first time we heard from our satellites after they were launched, our engineer screamed, oh, I hear my babies.
Oh, that is so sweet.
That's nice.
Oh, it's wonderful. On that happy note, I can't think of a better way to end this episode and this conversation than with that happy note. Those are my babies. Andy, I really want to thank you. You have given us so much to think about, the space technology, the science, and just the joy of being able to play with these things for a living, for a life. I mean, that sounds so cool.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, really. And I appreciate you having me on here so I can sit here and geek out for a little bit.
The pleasure is absolutely ours. Alan, as always, thank you so much for what you do. We really, really appreciate it. All right. Andy, if we want to contact you or if we can find out more about MyRadar or your cool satellite projects, how can we find you?
Yeah, so you can go to MyRadar.com. You can find out all about the web, find out all about the app, and you can download the app right from there. And if you want to hear a little bit more about what we're doing and what our plans are for space, you can go to MyRadar.com/space, or I think it's MyRadar.space.
Oh, oh, awesome. Forget the .com part. Just go right to .space.
Exactly.
That is very, very cool. Andy, thank you again. What a pleasure this has been.
Thank you. Thank you.
Alan, thank you again. What a pleasure this has been.
Thanks.
And for you all, if you like what you see and hear, please support us on Patreon. And as always, thank you for being with us. Thank you for being a part of the Lunarverse.